Thank you for joining me for today's sixth CEU seminar called Learning to Love, Fix, and Care Less. This is about clients who are in relationships with toxic others. As you probably are aware, if you worked in the mental health field long enough, we have so many clients whose presenting concerns relate to the fact that they are in unhealthy interpersonal relationships. Oftentimes, I know I've come across clients that are trying to help, fix, and care for someone else who really is not at a place where they even want to be helped, cared for, or fixed, that they don't necessarily want to learn healthy relationship skills. So today we're going to talk largely about the idea of codependency, of being in relationships where there's a learned behavior over time which is reinforced, a behavior which may not be healthy, but where someone's taking on that caretaking role for someone else, thereby enabling them to continue the toxic behavior. So again, as I said, this is a long-term pattern. This is a relational pattern that oftentimes is learned or seen or observed in childhood, maybe at a young age, where there's this illusion of security. It's almost like the person who's a codependent would rather have consistent instability because it gives them that false sense of being in control. But basically, what ends up happening at the later stages, it leaves people feeling resentful. Both the toxic person that they're in relationship with and the codependent themselves. The codependent ends up feeling really resentful because even though they've chosen to help and care for the other, they get to a point where they're like, gosh, they're not wanting to do anything for themselves. I'm always the one giving. I'm always the one helping and reaching out. And then the other person gets resentful because they're thinking, I never asked for your help in the first place. I didn't even want it. I wanted you to leave me alone. I wanted you to let me continue doing the behaviors I was doing. And we see that a lot with people in addiction cycles. We see that with people with personality disorders, where they're not wanting to change, where they believe their behaviors, even though they're toxic, are useful. So a great amount of energy is actually being put forth by this person at maintaining an unhealthy relationship. And it's interesting because then those of us who are therapists can look at it from the outside and see all this energy being put forth thinking, well, gosh, why in the world is this person putting forth so much energy when, you know, it's tearing them down? We can see what it's doing to that person. So it's almost like they are on this moral high of seeing themselves as this caring, loving, completely unselfish person. But really, in the long run, it's really about maintaining this illusion of things being okay. We'll talk a little bit later about the cognitive behavioral messages behind this. There's almost like this extreme idea of turn the other cheek no matter what. No matter how hurt I am, no matter how worn down I am, no matter how toxic something is. And so we see, we see that oftentimes the person with the codependent qualities has a sense of changing his or her behavior frequently just to keep changing to the people they're in relationships with because they want to be loved, quote, loved, accepted, no matter what. So we hear a lot of this sense of, I don't even know who I am anymore. If you try to get to the root with a client who battles with codependency and has a pattern of being in toxic relationships, a lot of times self-respect is pretty much the last thing you'll see on their list. They want approval or agreement. They'd rather not rock the boat. They'd rather maintain the status quo, even if it means enabling another person in toxic behavior. So basically what we're seeing is a positive impulse that's gone awry. So it's not just caring about someone, as we all should do in relationships, but it's caring for them. Now notice that distinction. Caring about, I'm doing, you know, I'm allowing them to be themselves. I'm being distinct. There's some degree of separation. There might be a little overlap in our relationships versus caring for, I'm doing the work for the other person that they're not doing. So ironically, it actually, by the behavior of the codependent person, takes the other toxic person away from their ability to even try and learn or maintain more healthy behaviors. One of the authors that I looked at in terms of preparing for the seminar used the phrasing of codependency as a disease of the lost self. This person takes pride in being a rescuer, a confidant, and a support. It's basically almost like an obsession and compulsion or a preoccupation with other people. They will try to obtain love at all costs, even from a difficult person, even from someone whose behavior has proved that it's not dependable. Recall again that usually if you look back at the behavior of someone with this toxic pattern as a codependent, because they're just as toxic as the person they're in relationship with, you see patterns that root from childhood. If you look back and you do some narrative therapy work, you can see some influence from parents, from guardians, and from caregivers, or a lack of influence. You can see repetitive messages, things like protect the family at all costs, don't let family secrets get out, make sure that the peace, quote unquote, of the family is maintained. Essentially, the messages that surround codependency do not allow for individuality and growth. So the self is stunted. So that's why we keep coming up with this phrase of, I don't know who I am. I hear this so many times from clients that are coming in that have codependent qualities. When I ask them and we try to engage in a conversation about who they are or who they want to be, their language tends to be in reference to whoever they're in relationship with. So we'll talk about four core elements that tend to keep coming up when we're talking about people that are codependent. They tend to be external focusing, meaning, again, looking at everyone else around them, even people who won't do their part, who don't want to learn how to be healthy, or are tearing them down. They also tend to be self-sacrificing. Now, they may give an illusion of not being controlling, but really at the core, they want a lot of interpersonal control. That's why, again, they're doing the caring for the other person, not just caring about the other person. And we also tend to see emotional suppression until, as I said earlier, it gets to the latter stages where then there's just bitterness and resentment. So let's take a look at each of these four areas. External focusing. They're so focused on the other people around them that they will adapt to whatever's happening around them. That's again where that lost self comes in. They will change their response just so they can anticipate what will or won't get approval from someone. So if they think the person they're in relationship with won't approve of or won't like them anymore, they'll change their behavior to something that will make the person stay in relationship with them, even if it's hurtful and toxic, even if it stunts their own growth. On the other hand, if they guess, believe, or anticipate that there's something they can do that will keep the relationship going, even if it means supporting someone's alcohol habit, they'll do it. I remember at the hospital I worked at that there have been a number of cases of people who actually would go out and buy the alcohol for the person they're in a relationship with. And you think, well, how is that helping them get sober? But again, the codependents were not wanting to lose the person in relationship. I remember in one case it was so bad that someone had just gone through detox, had just gotten sober, and I remember the person doing the psychosocial assessment asked the alcoholic, well, how in the world are you getting this if it's not in the house? And their answer was, this other person that I'm in relationship with, they're buying it for me. They want me to stay happy, so they know to keep the alcohol stocked. Now, to most of us, that would sound pretty sad. That would be like, gosh, they're really maintaining toxic relationship dynamics at all cost. Instead of allowing for that alcoholic to be upset and making it somewhat difficult for them to find the alcohol, they'd rather buy it so that the alcohol doesn't get angry with them. They'd rather enable the toxic behavior. So avoiding disagreement at all costs, focusing on other people. Basically, the codependent will look at this as being very self-sacrificing. It kind of masquerades as they're kind, they're caring, they're helpful. Again, it's caring for others rather than about others. Rather than allowing there to be boundaries and standards where the other person has to do their part. At the root, the person with the codependent qualities really does have low self-esteem. And there's this drive for perfectionism. They never put themselves on the list of people to be cared for. Oftentimes, I'll see people that are quote-unquote helping, and I will make a comment to them during the early stages of treatment planning about, oh, so I hear you're helping family, you're helping this friend, you're volunteering this other place. Tell me a little bit about at what point do you get to be put on the list? And they look at me with this really dumbfounded look, like, what, me, put on the list? No, kind people don't do that. So they don't put themselves on the list of people to care for. Self-care is a huge issue that will need to be addressed in terms of treatment planning because it's just not something that you generally see. And you have to also prepare the codependent when you are doing that in treatment planning about self-care goals because they likely will get some pushback from the people around them who are used to them doing everything for them. So when we talk about the ethics of sharing the pros and cons of a given treatment method, it would be important to share the side effects, quote unquote, of actually learning some boundary setting. Because I can remember some cases. I remember one in particular where I had a 50-something-year-old mom who had always enabled her child. And it got so bad, the person was getting in trouble with the law. There was some substance use. He lost job after job. Even though the young man was in his 20s and should have some level of responsibility for his behavior, mom would drive over an hour to and from to make sure the son would have a job because he couldn't drive himself, would give him certain day-to-day things to help him out, would basically do things for him. In addition, she bought him a place to stay. She took a third job on herself. So basically, when it got to the point that the young man got in court, instead of being held accountable for his actions, really mom was rescuing him in an unhealthy way. So there's a sense that the codependent believes that they have to intervene all the time. That in order to be seen as generous, kind, giving, and helpful, they need to fix the other people's behavior around them. They also tend to suppress their own emotions. That when things become, quote unquote, too much, they just keep stuffing it down. What we see is a lot of times there's this compulsive caretaking behavior. Really at the root, there's high anxiety. Because imagine if you allow in a relationship to actually be healthy, there's going to be some level of tension. Think about for yourself. If you're in a healthy relationship with a spouse, significant other, friend, coworker, sometimes there are tensions. But you come to expect that when you're in a healthy relationship, that there's two-way understanding, there's two-way empathy, there's sometimes disagreement, but there's a level of respect and allowance for that. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen with the codependent. So what happens with codependents, they look for excessive affection and approval, or they feel incomplete. So they restrict their behavior. It may even get to the extreme where they use manipulative tactics because they don't want to feel weak or out of control. They try to restrict behaviors to get desired outcomes. So when that codependent person is coming to you, what type of behaviors do you expect to see? Oftentimes they'll come in with depression or anxiety. They'll come in saying they don't have any happiness in life. All that's been taken away. They don't know the last time they felt enjoyment in life. So it may masquerade as depression or anxiety or some type of mood disorder. But the more you talk with them, you as a therapist will start to see, oh, okay, they're voluntarily allowing themselves to be robbed of joy because their, quote, joy is in putting all this effort forth in a toxic relationship. They may also come in with presenting concerns of feeling drained in relationships. They put forth so much energy for this other person that there's really nothing left for themselves. Maybe they're not sleeping well. Maybe they're worried about what's going to happen next with this other person. There's a high level of stress and really a lot of reactivity. Intimacy is not present in relationships. Just like I said a few minutes ago, if you think of healthy relationships that you yourself might be in, there is some level of tension. And that's to be expected. But there's allowances made for that. That's where intimacy comes in. With intimacy, there's vulnerability. And vulnerability doesn't have to be a bad thing. In a healthy relationship, there's an expectation of some mutual vulnerability. Intimacy isn't just about physical attraction and sexuality. Intimacy is about an openness and communication where each party can authentically be themselves. But this is what we see missing in a codependent pattern of relationship. There's this constant striving to be good, loving, perfect, and ideal. A lot of times another way you can note that someone's codependent is you'll hear that why question. You know, why does this keep happening to me? How come every relationship I'm in, I never can figure out why people leave? Why do people keep doing me wrong? Why can't I be good enough? Why can't I work hard enough? I guess I wasn't able to fix enough. I put so much effort in, but it wasn't good enough. So why oftentimes is paired with that sense of enough, which again, we know there's no real cutoff of enough. So they're asking why questions in their mind. Why is this happening to me? Because if only in their mindset, if only they could understand why, then they could avoid painful thoughts and feelings. They could eliminate emotional conflict as if they could make the decision for the other party as well. They could avoid perceived threats. They could cope with abuse. So there's a lot of tiredness that these people feel. They're putting up with things that most of us wouldn't put up with. Deep down, there's often unspoken toxic messages. It's very rare that you hear people actually say these directly, but some of the toxic messages are things like, don't think. In other words, don't express your feelings. Don't express your thoughts. Just keep it to yourself. Don't share openly about your perspective on a matter. Because God knows that could rock the boat. And basically, maybe you'll lose love and approval that you think you've worked so hard for. Don't explore, learn, or be who you are. Just juggle and be who everyone else wants you to be. The ultimate is this living for someone else. Living with the goal of your life being caring for someone else. You may have heard this, for example, when you see parents of teenagers or young adults, where the young adults maybe have no sense of responsibility or no drive. They don't want to get a job. They don't want to do things for themselves. And the parents saying, oh, if I had been a good enough mom, if I had been this, then only my child would A, B, and C. But the fact is, at some point, there's got to be some level of expectation and accountability for that young adult. I remember I had a situation years ago in therapy where a mother of a 25 and a 28-year-old came in, and she said one of her kids wouldn't get out of his room. That he said, I'm going to be the next famous rock star. Leave me alone. Let me play my guitar all day. Don't even try to hold me accountable for showering or doing daily tasks. And this mom was crying and said, well, should I have rules? I haven't had rules all these years. I don't want to upset my son. Talk about a toxic relationship. Now the young man is, quote, stuck in her home. The mom refused to give him boundaries about getting a job, about applying for a job, about getting out of the home by a certain time frame. And she doesn't want to rock the boat because her son is, quote, telling her he's going to be the next rock star and she better leave him alone. So she was coming in torn apart inside saying, gosh, I don't want to upset him. When we talked about the idea of even setting boundaries, she said, I didn't do this all these years. Is it too late now? So talk about trying, you know, to undo a pattern and how difficult that is. So again, there's other toxic messages that we see. Things like only happy feelings are allowed or no feelings are allowed. Don't be who you are. Don't think or feel. Don't be vulnerable. Just take care of everyone else around you. We see people that are codependent oftentimes saying yes to everything, even things that they would rather not do. We see instead of learning what I call a healthy no, or a no, you know, a yes with conditions, that people don't do that. One of the most helpful things that I have taught clients is how to live in the space of wait, W-A-I-T. What I mean by that is a codependent so used to being quick to say yes, even on things that they don't want to do, that creating a pause, getting the information, allowing some time to lapse before they answer the other person about their decision about helping or not can even be tough for them. I remember assigning a homework task to one person that I counseled about learning to tell someone when people would ask for different tasks and expectations to say, oh, I hear that you're wanting this. And I'd like to be able to be there for you, but right now I'm going to have to check my schedule or I'm going to need to get back with you. And we started with only 15 minutes, you know, get back with you in 15 minutes. Or in an hour or two, I'd like to give you a call back so we can talk about that a little more. So learning to create the pause, that alone can be a challenge for a codependent person. That alone can be a challenge for someone who is doing caring for someone else. I remember one of my past clients had so many people in her life that she was doing the caring for, but yet inside she was coming to me with a lot of anger issues. She said that one of them in particular was partially blind, couldn't drive, and needed assistance, but had other people that could help her in addition to the client myself. So she said, well, how come I'm always the one that does everything? How come I always say yes? So I taught her how to create that pause, create that wait, set people up, to have to consider other resources they have. Because honestly, if the person who's toxic could be in the relationship with a codependent, they can also find other resources to meet their needs. And that's something that sometimes I've even had to say to a client directly. So creating that pause or creating conditions for I'm willing and able to help you with such and such if, and then whatever the condition is, if it's at this time or if I can do A, B, and C. That's really challenging. You know, you may do that in your day-to-day life, but again, for a codependent to actually possibly rock the boat that much feels devastating, and their level of anxiety is through the roof. You have to prepare them for that because they're not naturally assertive. They oftentimes lack boundaries with people, and they're so used to doing things they don't want to do. Really, in the long run, in the latter stages of codependency, we end up seeing someone who at first was caring for someone else, was priding themselves on being helpful and kind, and eventually they are just an angry person. When I've seen primarily women that have been codependent and they've come to me and they're actually ready to make some change is usually when they're really ticked off. Usually when they're like, man, I've lost so much money trying to take care of these kids that won't do things for themselves. I've lost so much self-respect being in relationships with guys who don't treat me right. So inside, there's an anger and resentment building up over time. People that oftentimes are trying to search for this false love, this false intimacy, who are prone to these patterns, tend to be abuse and trauma victims. And it's an ironic cycle because it's like they've gone through abuse before, so you think that they might want to avoid it, but yet there's almost like this helpless, I'm going to keep trying, I'm going to keep trying. I'll be the one that'll make a difference. Other people that might be affected by these cycles are families, where the good of the parents is put above the good of the kids or each individual. You see families where it's kind of children are to be seen and not heard. Families that are overbearing or domineering. You also see this pattern of denying problems. Disregard your own needs. Don't be human. Don't communicate. And it results in a real challenge whereby the codependent person has lost him or herself, has lost a sense of identity, and just doesn't know what to do from there. In addition to learning that healthy no or wait that I talked about a little bit, one of the other parts that I will focus on in therapy is the idea of basic problem solving. That can feel horrible to a person who battles codependency. They fear being someone who is seen as less kind. They fear that people won't love them anymore. And they tend to have this confusion between love and pity. When they're actually feeling sorry for someone, they try to rescue them. And this results in their feeling angry and frustrated because they're doing more than their share. As I said before, there's this compelling need to control others. Another technique I've used with people who I've seen as having codependent traits is to help them ask themselves the question in each situation, whose responsibility is this really? That's not an automatic question for them. Their automatic response is to dive in, help, and do things for someone else. But what would it be like if they ask, whose responsibility is this? I remember one lady who I started doing that with in session, and eventually she got to a point of saying, oh, right, I got to ask myself about if this is really my responsibility. In other words, is this my job? Is this my task? Is this something I'm supposed to be owning? And she got to a point where over time, that became the norm, where she started in her healing process asking herself, wait a minute, am I supposed to do this? And for her, it was an issue of, if I intervene, I'm a good Christian. If I intervene, I'm right with God. If I intervene and do things for other people, I'm being kind and helpful. And so we had to really address that irrational belief of, that absolute of, oh, if I don't intervene, if I set a boundary, or if I require that other person to do things for themselves, then am I being mean? No. Am I lacking in my faith? No, not necessarily. So asking whose responsibility is this? Challenging unrealistic assumptions about taking on the job of making everyone else happy. We see people who have these codependent patterns trying to be martyrs, benefactors, being drawn to the needy, having lack of trust in themselves, having really chronic anger underlying everything, and insecurities and anxieties. What they're trying to do is frantically avoid what they perceive as possible abandonment. There's this idea where they're living in a place of constant fear. If I do A, B, and C, how might this other person react? So that second guessing. I mean, imagine living in that place where you're trying to proactively think ahead of, if I do this, if they do this, then this will happen, then I have to do this. That's a lot of work. There's times I've even said to someone that I'm dealing with in therapy that, wow, I feel tired just hearing that. That sounds very draining and very fatiguing, you know, that it would just wear you out. But deep down, the thing that you can capitalize on in therapy with someone with these qualities is that they really want to be loved. And intimacy, I mean, real authentic intimacy is a very good goal in therapy. Even if that's two-way healthy intimacy, meaning therapeutically, with, you know, ethical boundaries in a clinical relationship where there's respect and freedom and safety in your office for them to actually think, for them to actually be vulnerable, for them to not only share their opinion, but maybe do some role plays about how they could directly, assertively, and with boundaries, talk about what their expectations are. One of the other things you may want to try that can be helpful in the therapeutic relationship is helping that codependent person talk through what their fears are, their uncertainty about the alternatives. Because they just see as there's no alternative to caring for the other person. But what would it be like if there were other choices? That there's actually a continuum. People pleasing. We see people pleasing to the extreme with codependents. Like we said, they guess ahead about what someone wants. But what they oftentimes don't realize is that there's actually deception underlying all this. This is something after you've established the beginning of the therapeutic relationship and you feel like it's at a point where you can start confronting things in a gentle way with the client, I would actually confront the idea of deception. Now, when I'm saying deception, I don't mean that the codependent's purposely trying to harm or hurt or manipulate the person they're in a relationship with, But what I mean is the codependent's deceiving him or herself and the other person because they're saying yes when they mean no to tests. Because they're smiling and acting as if things are okay when they're definitely not okay. Because they're pretending and trying on different modes of self that's really not who they are. So honestly, when we talk about authenticity and vulnerability in relationship, it's not there. So that's where deception comes in. Another area that might be useful to confront when you get to a level in therapy where you feel like you can do this is the idea of the codependent person actually teaching other people how to treat them. This is a new way of thinking that oftentimes codependents haven't considered before. The codependent's behavior by being deceptive, by taking on not just their own stuff, but other people's stuff, teaches other people to disrespect them. It teaches the narcissist that they're in relationship with to emotionally and verbally beat them down. It teaches the avoidant family member to not confront their issue. It teaches the addict they're in relationship with to not get serious about their sobriety. You see how that happens? And again, a lot of times we're talking about a long-standing pattern of being in the middle of abuse, of dishonesty, of double messages, of disregard for opinions, of blame. What's the alternative? What are we trying to get the codependent to see? I might share with them what I call the healthy family of origin messages and see how they respond. They probably would be in shock initially and not even understand how this could be possible. So healthy rules that we'd eventually want them to get to are things that children can express feelings without feeling judged or criticized. They have room to explore. They have room to develop an identity. There's not this sense of a double life. I'll act one way outwardly, but inside feel conflicted about it all along. There's not these family secrets or issues that are being swept under the rug. There's allowance for people being frail and making mistakes. There's fairness in terms of boundaries. Even things like chores and responsibilities, that everyone has some level of expectation of that. Everyone should be accountable for his or her actions. In terms of intimacy and relationships, there's listening with a level of respect for all. Rules are made as a team. Everyone's respected. What happens when those types of healthy rules are not there, there's a number of different kind of roles that may result. You might see one codependent come in as the hero. They're going to make things better. They will be perfect in school. They will achieve on their job. They will not do anything wrong. They will be helpful. They will be kind. Everyone around them will like them. And that way, you know, we're not going to really talk or address the issues that are going on around. There's also the adjuster. They learn to flip-flop. They learn to constantly modify every thought and behavior to everyone around them. There's the placator. That person, just tries to minimize the level of tension. So that could be, again, that they're not sharing opinions. That could be the person I referred to earlier who goes out and says, you know what, to shut you up, I'm going to go out and get your booze. I'm going to go ahead and make sure you keep drinking so that I don't have to hear from you, your anger, your disappointment, because I'm holding you accountable. Scapegoating. We see some people in their family of origin with this pattern who end up just allowing themselves to be the one that's blamed for everything, as if there's just one cause for things. Some people end up being the lost child. It's almost like, oh, we didn't even know you existed. Where were you in the middle of all this? Or the mascot. So there's all these different roles at play. This goes to highlight the fact that every codependent that comes to us, every person that's in the middle of a toxic relationship, is definitely not the same. You can have one person with straight A's trying to be perfect, another one who says, you know, I can't be good, I might as well be good at being bad. I'll be defiant, rebellious, and angry. I remember one young man that I counseled years ago, and that's what he said. He said, I don't know what people expect of me. Such and such is happening at home. This other stuff is happening in the school. I'm just tired of all this stuff. I can't be the good person everyone wants me to be, so I might as well be good at being bad. And when he said that, that really gave us something to work on in our therapy sessions. It was surprising. You can have the lost child. When I say child, I'm just not talking about someone who's under 18. You can have someone who's 50, 60, 70, who is still struggling with being withdrawn and isolated, still feeling shy, lonely, and sad, still wondering where they fit in. You can have another person coming into you that clowns and jokes around to take the focus off these actual serious issues. I remember one client of mine who even said to me, do you ever notice that I tend to laugh when things are really serious? Of course, I had noticed that, but I thought it was rather interesting that she made that comment herself. She said, yeah. She said, I don't like talking about those kind of serious things. And when I laugh, then people can't focus on that issue anymore. Then they have to focus on my laugh. I found that quite interesting. So imagine the price that the codependent person is paying, not realizing that they're choosing to pay this price. Price of extreme fatigue, tiredness, a false sense of control, loneliness, pushing people away, always feeling worried. I mean, imagine the work that goes into checking your next step. What are you going to do? What's the other person going to do? And never really knowing true intimacy. I would say one of the greatest sense of results or therapeutic goals that we could do for a client or with a client in therapy would be helping them to cultivate true or genuine intimacy. If we could get them to a point where they could learn how to do that, that would be absolutely amazing. Because again, what people tend to think falsely of as true intimacy is more of a thing like, it's just falsehood. It's just a mask. It's just deception. They're not being true to themselves. They're not being spontaneous. They're not being fun. There's fears. Their needs are not being met. And ultimately, they're looking to other people to stop their pain. They're trying to have an escape from reality, an escape from things that are healthy in relationship. So you see how their behavior is really, really toxic. There's other side effects that we may see as well. They may have imbalances in prioritizing. Because remember, for the person who's codependent, their priority is everybody and everything else around them. Again, the word that just comes to mind is tired. I would feel really, really exhausted if I was always thinking of and prioritizing everybody else around me. It's almost like an all or nothing thinking. There's no in between. Either I'm caring for other people, caring not just about them, but caring for them, or there's not any relationship. It gives that illusion of being one up in the relationship, of being the moral role model. so there's a sense of disillusionment. And they feel like overworked. They feel like they put so much time and energy into things that they just need a break. I remember one lady I talked to, the one I referred to earlier, that her son was in the courts. She ended up getting a third job to cover for his misbehavior. And for her, I remember asking her, when is it enough? When will you know that you've done enough for him? Because initially she said, I want to help get him over the hurdle. And I thought, okay, you've tried to get him over hurdles and hurdles and hurdles all his life. And when she said it as if this was the very first time she had ever done that. I said, so after you get him over this hurdle, how will you know when he's past the hurdle and it's done? And she paused for quite some time and realized that she really didn't know the answer to that. She's like, I don't know. So I had to get her to think, what if he never picks up the responsibility for the hurdle? What if he never works towards getting his license back? What if he never chooses to apply for jobs himself and be a productive citizen? You're already getting 3 jobs. Are you going to get a 4th or a 5th? Are you just not going to sleep? I mean, it was a very difficult conversation, but it was an eye-opener for her. Codependency, like any other disease or disorder, tends to progress. It can start with the fear and the caretaking things, but it gets to a point where the person's so trying to do everything right that they take everything personally, that everything becomes serious, they tolerate almost anything, that shame is high, sense of abandonment is high, they're constantly guessing what the other people around them are going to do. So they're trying to make people like them, trying to earn rewards, not rock the boat, and have a false peace. You may have heard of author Melody Beatty, who wrote the series of books on codependency. I wanted to read an example from her book that really summarizes the struggle that codependents go through. I stopped living my own life. I stopped thinking. I stopped feeling positive emotions, and I was left with rage, bitterness, hatred, fear, depression, helplessness, despair, and guilt. At times I wanted to stop living. I had no energy. Spent most of my time worrying about people and trying to figure out how to control them. I could say no to anything but fun activities if my life depended on it, and it did. My relationships with friends and family were in shambles. I felt terribly victimized. I lost myself and didn't know how it happened. I didn't know what had happened. I thought I was going crazy, and I thought, shaking a finger at the people around me, it's their fault. Sadly, aside from myself, no one knew how badly I felt. And you see the interesting pattern here. As this person's being caring and giving and putting their all in, yet they're still angry at the people around them for putting them through this, even though they've chosen it at some level. So eventually, we're trying to help the codependent person get to a point where they're seeking out healthy relationship supports, where there's room for challenging beliefs and behaviors that don't work, where there's room to modify and change behaviors that are not healthy, and where vulnerability is allowed. What happens is there's this concept that the literature calls limerence. The emotions of the codependent flip-flop based on the people they're in relationships with. They can be immensely joyful and happy, and they can be in immense despair, depending on what's going on around them. They're longing for connection at all cost, and they can't handle any doubts or instability. One of the worst things that people can do, but oftentimes happens, that makes this limerence even worse, is when people have sexual relations with someone else. Because then there's that level of closeness of, okay, now I'm stuck with you for a long time. Now I'm going wherever you're going, and I'm going to feel whatever you feel. And it can even get to the point of obsession. They've even found that there's some patterns. Now listen very closely to this. For codependents that actually mimic obsessive compulsive types of disorders and drug highs, it does something to them chemically when they keep caring, giving, fixing, helping. Something changes. It's an addiction. I actually may give a client some questions to think about if they're thinking, I don't think I'm codependent. I may have them read some of those books like the Codependent No More from Melanie Beatty and do this checklist that I've come up with regarding codependent thoughts and let them sit with it a while. Just let them know that there are other people who have similar qualities and that they're not alone in that, but there is a way of moving beyond it. Questions that are on the self-evaluation include things like, do you keep quiet to avoid arguments? Are you always worried about others' opinions of you? Have you ever lived with someone with an alcohol or drug problem? And I might add to that other addictions as well. It could be food, it could be buying, it could be gambling, any other repetitive behavior. Have you ever lived with someone who hits or belittles you? Are the opinions of others more important than your own? Do you have difficulty adjusting to changes at work or home? Do you feel rejected when significant others spend time with friends? Do you doubt your ability to be who you want to be? Are you uncomfortable expressing your true feelings to others? Have you felt inadequate? Do you feel like a bad person when you've made a mistake? Now, I do want to say, notice this word in quotes, bad. That's another way that we can teach clients to catch the irrational thoughts and the toxic behaviors. I'm good if I care. I'm bad if I make mistakes. Again, very subjective adjectives. Do you have difficulty taking compliments or gifts? Do you feel humiliation when your child or spouse makes a mistake? Remember the example I gave earlier of the moms who said, basically that their children were a reflection of them? Do you think people in your life would go downhill without your efforts? Do you wish someone could help you get things done? Do you have difficulty talking to people in authority, like the police or your boss? Are you confused about who you are or where you're going in life? Do you have difficulty saying no? Do you have trouble asking for help for yourself? Do you have so much going on at once? So these are some important questions that someone can consider in a self-evaluation around the issue of codependency. Other things that I might have them look at on a checklist are facts like, I don't try to become friends with people who may not like me. No matter what, others come first. My life is controlled by other people and their behavior. Other people are my first priority. My life is governed by what other people think are good, right, and ideal things. I feel like I've lost myself. I must be liked and approved by others. If others would only change in certain ways, and I could help them to do this, then things would be better. That's another tool you can use with clients, is this if only. When I do cognitive behavioral therapy with clients, I'll help them notice those thought patterns, the shoulds, the if such and such happened enough, if only A, B, and C, then such and such would happen? Because again, there's a lot of contingencies. And funny thing is, they don't verbalize that to the person they're in a relationship with. There's also this open-ended, well, maybe someday things will get better. Some of the self-messages cause things like unworthiness. They feel guilty about feelings, and they fear abandonment if they share their own feelings. Another feeling that codependents struggle with often is a sense of being unimportant. They feel guilt about other people's feelings. So, wow, all the way around, they're feeling guilt. Guilt about what they feel, guilt about what other people feel. They just can't get it right, huh? They fear criticism. They feel unlovable as a person. They're afraid of rejection. They're worried about others' actions and needs. They can even get to a point where they're self-loathing and low self-worth. There's a lot of different types of personality patterns that codependents may exhibit in reaction to these toxic relationships. They can blame at some points in time. They can get sick and tired of the caring for role that they've been in. So they can get to a point of getting angry and it's all your fault, the other person's fault. The placators, whatever you say, just go along with it. Continue to not rock the boat. They can apologize, be it not a genuine apology, but a sense of, oh, I'm sorry you feel that way. They can distract, try and refocus on something else instead of what the other person's saying or doing. They can take the seductive route, try to make up with some intimacy. Again, false intimacy, non-authentic intimacy. They can minimize. They can withdraw and try to not talk about certain things. They can become attacking. They can try and act like a professional, or they can try and be a martyr. So ultimately, there's a sense with a codependent of not knowing what is, quote, normal. This is why oftentimes they're in relationships with other toxic people. Imagine in an alcoholic family, there's no sense of normal. Imagine in an abusive family, there's no sense of normal. There's always a sense of, how should I feel? What do I think? How do I even form an opinion? How do I make the, quote, unquote, right decision? How do I react if I'm hurt? Am I able to enjoy positives? And how do I do that? What am I allowed to have? Instead, there's a sense of I need to be good, right, strong, perfect, kind, helpful, not selfish, and caring. So you see how these things are actually maladaptive. The codependent person is assuming responsibility for meeting others' needs. They're believing distortions. They're enmeshed in relationships with personality disordered, chemically dependent, or other codependent or impulse disordered individuals. There's a sense of false control. One of the homework assignments I've done with some codependent people is actually helping them to learn to feel. Naming and identifying feelings can be very challenging for the codependent person. I remember one lady in particular who was really prone to this. And we started with as little as 2 minutes just sitting and just being. Codependents are so used to both mentally and behaviorally being active and doing. But to sit and be with themselves, their feelings, their body sensations, whatever's going on, is torture. So this one woman, we started with a few minutes, and she kept saying that initially she was thinking of, oh gosh, if the stuff in the house is not done, what's going to happen? And I had to say to her, okay, so in 2 minutes, something's going to become an absolute disaster. The house is just going to be a wreck. That 2 minutes of obsessive cleaning would make all the difference in the world. And we actually got to laugh at that a little bit. But when we put it in the proper context, she realized, 2 minutes, really? Even a half hour, an hour is usually not going to make or break things. I remember it was slow going because for her, 2 minutes was tough. Even we were at the 5 minute for a while because there was a struggle. We had to process in session all the thoughts that were going on in those 5 minutes. Initially, she felt like the 5 minutes was torture. And the idea, eventually when she got up to 30 minutes and could have 30 minutes to do something for herself, whether it be take a bath, whether it be listen to some music, whether it be just lay and rest on the couch a little bit, whether it be watch a TV show, she ended up telling me she wasn't allowed to do that. And honestly, it wasn't that anybody else was telling her she wasn't allowed. It was that she had this assumption that the world would fall apart if she didn't stay in this constantly active mode. Now, the positive thing that brought me so much joy was that by about 6 months later, this woman actually, for the first time in years and years, was able to use the hot tub that she and her husband had that was sitting there unused. She was able to take a bath and put on candles and just relax. She actually watched some TV shows her friends told her about and she had not been able to see. She actually hung out with her husband and they just fell in love more authentically that she hadn't felt in years. I'm not saying there weren't several bumps in the road, but in the long run, it's amazing to see the joy when someone's like, wow, the world doesn't actually fall apart if I'm not in control all the time. So why would a codependent keep up their behavior then? If they could experience this authentic intimacy, one, a lot of times, they just don't know any better. Remember, they've been in a repetitively reinforced pattern. I even sometimes have to say to a client, you know, what would it be like if things did go well? If the things you're most fearing actually didn't happen? Sometimes clients are afraid that things could succeed, that someone could actually listen to their opinion, that their feelings and thoughts might actually matter. Sometimes they just don't know or have the skills for assertiveness, for boundary setting. Sometimes there's unfinished business where they haven't dealt with their own pain and suffering and abuse. I'd like to give an example about how sometimes a codependent will continue to subject him or herself to toxic things, not realizing that they don't have to. This is from a story that's in one of the books that I reference in the bibliography. And I would encourage you, if you ever did any kind of like a group therapy with codependents, to use something like this story as a means for discussion for people to talk through what it's like to continue to subject themselves to toxic things when they really don't have to. Once upon a time, a woman moved to a cave in the mountains to study with a guru. She wanted to learn everything there was to know. The guru supplied her with stacks of books and left her alone so that she could just study. Every morning, the guru returned to the cave to monitor the woman's progress. In his hand, he carried a heavy wooden cane. Each morning, he would ask her the same question. Have you learned everything there is to know yet? Each morning, her answer was the same. No, she said, I haven't. The guru would strike her over the head with his cane. This scenario repeated itself for months. One day the guru entered the cave, asked the same question, heard the same answer, and he raised his cane to hit her in the same way. But the woman grabbed the cane from the guru, stopping his assault in midair. Relieved to end the daily batterings, but refusing reprisal, the woman looked up at the guru. To her surprise, the guru smiled. Congratulations, he said. You have graduated. You now know everything you need to know. So you see, sometimes people subject themselves to all they've ever known. They get in this toxic cycle of seeking approval, then becoming obsessed with doing the good, right, strong, perfect things, figuring things out, having control, then getting to a point eventually of resentment and rebellion. Let's, for just a minute here, compare and contrast the codependent, unhealthy, toxic ways of approaching relationship with the healthy ones. Sometimes it helps to actually go over with a client what the alternative would be and the idea that it is possible and there are therapeutic techniques that we can do to get there. So codependents are attracted to needy people. Again, gives them a sense of empowerment, being in control, and caring for someone else. On the other hand, a healthy person accepts help for themselves. Codependents feel like they're the most unselfish people in the world. They're selfless. Whereas healthy people ask for help when they need to. They don't deny things. And they set boundaries if they need to. Codependents, on the other hand, are people-pleasing. They're so focused on everybody else to the extent of losing themselves, as we said. They may not even know how to do self-care. It's very hard initially for a person with codependent patterns to even state what he or she wants or what a better life would look like. A lot of times they'll tell me what they don't want, and it's almost like we have to go from there to the point of what they'd rather have. So a healthy alternative would be helping the codependent person learn their self-identity, and what self-care is like. I'll give you an example here from one of my colleagues that I thought was really neat. He is a social worker, and he had a lady that he worked with, a client, who was very codependent, and she was focused on everything the family, the relatives needed, to the point of losing herself. She would make little comments in the session off and on about things she wanted to do but could never do. She had to, in her mindset, had to see the kids through school, had to do this for the other relatives, had to help, had to care, had to control. And so eventually the social worker asked, well, you know, when's it going to get to be your turn? And eventually they came up with someday, which would be after all the kids were done with college. Probably at least a decade or more from the time of the therapy. So for a homework assignment, the social worker gave that client an assignment of spending one day, just one day, not even a whole day, but part of a day, doing things that she was going to have to miss for the next 10 plus years. Going to her, quote, favorite restaurant. Going window shopping for clothes that she wouldn't be able to have because she couldn't do anything for herself. And when she came back to the next session, he said, you know, I want to support you in your goal. You're saying that your goal is that you really want to be there in every possible way for all these people around you. That is very important. And so you're resigned to the fact that you don't get to be put on the list for years. After the homework assignment, she came back and said, well, maybe I do want every now and then to go out to eat to somewhere I like. Maybe it might be nice to have something for myself somewhere in there. So sometimes actually doing some reality testing and homework assignments like that could be helpful. Again, the world doesn't cave in if the codependent's not caring for someone every minute of their life, or if they put themselves on the list. Codependents tend to be obsessed with other people. But one of the things we can teach in therapy is a distinction between caring for someone else and caring about someone else. Codependents spend a great deal of energy hiding their feelings, whereas one of the techniques we can teach a codependent is healthy assertiveness. One of the things I'll talk with a codependent about is how to do something like the I message. I feel such and such, when or because such and such circumstance, and I would like such and such behavior in the future. I even work with codependents on writing that down in a journal for themselves at home, because sometimes it's not even about the codependent getting what they want in a relationship with someone else. It's even on the first step, just the codependent learning to hear for himself or herself what it is that's meaningful, what they value. So it's moving the codependent from a place of desperation to confidence, to self-care, to more balanced perspective. You might need to even ask the client, reflect on what will happen if you continue the thoughts and behavior patterns as they are. Where will you be in 1 month? Where might you be in 6 months or a year or 5 years? Imagine if the codependent that's coming to you is already exhausted. They're already having health issues from taking on everybody's stuff. They're already having some anger and resentment. They really don't know who they are. They're already saying yes when they mean no. More of that, what would happen after that? Cognitive behavioral approaches can be especially helpful, helping the codependent watch out for that if-only-then thinking, or someday, or those contingencies that really are so linear, unlike life. As I said earlier, it's really important for the codependent to realize that they actually are teaching other people certain things. Their behavior is teaching other people that they're so smart, capable, and can handle anything and don't need help. That's why sometimes, as homework assignments, it might be useful to have a codependent ask for help on something that they really don't need help for, that they could do, but just to learn that the world doesn't cave in when they ask for help. Or to learn that they can reevaluate relationships. And if something doesn't turn out right, they do have other choices they can do. Codependents also teach people that they don't have needs. They're never stressed out. They're always accessible. They're a super person. Sometimes one of the things we can do for a codependent is help them grieve. They need to grieve that they're not this good, right, strong, perfect person. That really none of us are. That what they would like to happen and the way they would like things to go hasn't happened so far and probably won't happen. But that it's still okay. And they still can be a healthy person. And they still can make choices that are helpful for them. I can say there's so many clients that I've had to do some grief work with because, again, their family of origin messages were so off. There's moments where they may still experience shock because they've not dealt with abuse, trauma, neglect. They may still feel like, is this really happening to me? They may still try to make sense of things. So some of our therapy may need to go through guilt, or shame. Shame basically is personalizing something that's not personal. Instead of looking at a behavior and saying, oh, this behavior didn't turn out the way I'd like. Shame says, oh, you're flawed. And you hear that a lot of times, people who are codependent struggle with that. Anger issues, anxiety, which we talked about earlier, trying to guess what would happen if A, B, and C happened, and aggression. There's this struggle within the codependent about making meaning about things, how to express what's going on inside of them, and about being okay with needing social support. That they're not flawed because they need to reach out for someone else. Sometimes I'll even, after I've built a therapeutic relationship to a certain point, actually mention or confront this double message that codependents are there to care for others, but that they don't get that same thing in life. And I might even say, well, who says that? You know, where did that rule come from? How's that working out for you? And try and challenge and talk through that. Like, why do they get to be put in the category of people who don't need to have any care? Another exercise that may be helpful for codependents is the exercise of what do you want to be remembered for? So looking back on your life, okay, maybe the codependent wants to be thought of as a caring, giving individual, which there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But through this exercise, we would look at how do they define those things operationally? Is it that they were 24 hours on call for everybody around them and never did anything for themselves? Are there other ways of caring? Is it possible to care even when someone else doesn't define it as caring? And so we'll look at what are 3 to 5 things that they want to be remembered for, and what's a way that they could be remembered for those things. But, and you know, with healthy boundaries. For everyone at the core, for all people, regardless of whether they're codependent or not, there is a question of who am I? What is my identity? Where do I fit in? What do I want out of life? Where am I going? How will I know when I get there? And what resources do I need along the way? These are core questions. The literature shows that we have a dramatic impact on a client's ability to work through that answer to that question of who am I? Where do I belong? Am I acceptable? Do I matter? Mattering is a term we'll see in the literature a lot. Almost every disorder or mental health issue to some degree boils down to this concept of mattering. I like to read to you some lyrics from a 1955 song, The Great Pretender. And think about this in terms of a codependent, because really this is what they're going through. Inside they're thinking they're doing this really noble, caring for thing, but actually what's being portrayed is not really what's inside. Oh yes, I'm the great pretender, pretending that I'm doing well. My need is such, I pretend so much, I'm lonely, but no one can tell. Oh yes, I'm the great pretender. Adrift a world of my own. I've played the game, but to my real shame, you've left me to grieve all alone. Too real is this feeling of make-believe. Too real when I feel what my heart can't conceal. Yes, I'm the great pretender. Just laughing and gay as a clown. I seem to be what I'm not, you see. I'm wearing my heart like a crown, pretending that you're still around. I'd also like to read one other thing that was in the literature that, again, just represents the struggle that codependents go through that might put in context some of the stuff I've said thus far. It's called The Man in a Glass. When you get what you want in your struggle for yourself and the world makes you king for a day, just go to the mirror and look at yourself and see what that person has to say. For it isn't your mother or father or wife whose judgment you must pass. The person whose verdict counts most in your life is the one staring back from the glass. Now, some people can call you a straight shooting chum and think you're a wonderful guy, but the man in the glass says you're only a bum if you won't look him in the eye. He's the one to please. Never mind all the rest, for he's with you clear up to the end. And you pass your most dangerous and difficult test if the man in the glass can at least be your friend. You can fool the whole world down the pathway of years and get lots of pats on the back as you pass. But your final reward will be heartaches and fears if you cheat the man in the glass. So we're going to wrap up this first part of today's seminar on learning to love, fix, and care less. I'd encourage you to think a little about those song lyrics and poems that I just read, because really that's the life that someone with codependency is dealing with daily. That's the struggle that they're dealing with. A struggle of learned behaviors which have been reinforced. A struggle of desperation, of trying to be loved, trying to be so good and unselfish, but really actually doing deception, where they don't even realize they're deceiving themselves and someone else. Also a struggle where they don't even know where to begin of defining who they are, where there's a history of that word of limerence, of flip-flopping identities based on whoever they're in relationship with. But we do have an impact in that struggle. We can do things like teaching them boundaries, teaching them a healthy no or wait. We can use cognitive behavioral strategies to address and identify the negative patterns. We can help them learn to have time to just sit and be with themselves and be comfortable identifying their feelings, identifying their thoughts. We can learn to help them redefine intimacy in a healthy light, not just flip-flopping in relationships and responding to others, but actually proactively seeking out healthy, mutually vulnerable relationships where each person is allowed to authentically be himself or herself. Thank you again for joining me for this first portion of today's seminar, and we'll return shortly for the second portion.